that's right. Tape 80-5, side 2, 11 October.
Well, you're talking about 57. What kind of air support were you getting then at that time?
Okay, in country at that time, we had about five or six squadrons of F-100s. And they had one squadron at Tonsonute and another one or two up at Benoit. And those guys were such fast movers and could stay a very short time that they were kind of limited to us. But because they were the big numbers available, well, we finally had to say, look, we got to get with these fighter guys and, you know, talk out and work out tactics and so on, and which we did, and it worked much better after that, and we developed a very close.
You didn't have a tactical manual from headquarters to this guy.
No, nor did they on supporting us. So we got together some super guys there, you know, willing to work with us and knew our problem. And I remember Silver Flight was the one there at Tonsonute. We'd go over and talk with those guys, say, here's where we're going, here's the way we're going to do it. We're going to be hard to see. Here's what we're going to, you know, here's the pattern of the mission. So, that nose-to-nose worked out real good, to work out the optimum tactics, because they had probably 20 minutes that they could give us, depending on how far away we were and what they were carrying, see, to stay with us. So we had to adjust our mission accordingly, and we couldn't mess around. We had one or two passes here. Yeah. Was all that we could rely on, but we worked out very well. And some of the big area they were most helpful to us is out west of Saigon, about 15 miles. West River, we called it, and they did us a super job. They really saved us out there a couple of times when guys would have engines shot out. And
that's over toward the Parrot Beak area?
No, it's that was a little more northwest. Talking about southwest, down toward the Plain of Reeds down there. Uh-huh. It was a canal area that was pretty hot, actually about 12 to 15 miles west of Tonsonute. Our favorite airplane to work with us was the A-1, because they could speed be compatible with us. They had a large load and a long loiter time and could get right down there with us. And they did a good job. We also liked the B-57 for some of the same reasons. And we developed a great rapport with the Redbird and Yellowbird squadrons out of Da Nang with the B-57, because he had that, you know, that nose to nose. When the F-4s came along, we didn't use too many F-4s, and they were pretty fast movers for us. A few F-4s we used, some Marine A-4s that we used, and you know, they would, if our fighters didn't show up or had been diverted and they had to bring in another set of fighters to us, then they might show up with a 2,000-pound bomb or something like that, you know. That was the A-4 with the Marines. We had some 105s once or twice over in Laos, and that was, you know, they were willing, and they were good troops, but that was really tough, too. And let's see, what else did we have? Well, the dust-off choppers, we tried to get on every mission that we could to tag along with us. We couldn't get them in some of the areas up north, and we couldn't get the Air Force to recognize our need, but we had no trouble in selling it to the Army on the medevac dust-off to go with us. They had an interesting mission down in the Delta where they wanted to use us to troll for VC. They knew they had a regiment down there somewhere, and they came to us and asked us to go down along the big river and troll along and see if we could find out where they were mainly located due to the ground fire. And we agreed, and they put some 14 gunships down there along the trail and had a FAC at both ends of this long target area. And we brought a couple of flights of fighters down, F-100s, and we found them. And I think they report, as I recall, they got about 380 of them killed on that operation down there. And some very exciting moments.
Being bait on them.
Yeah. The, but that covers the gamut, as I recall it, on the fighter escort. Now, there was a period right after General Momar got there and took over 7th Air Force, about the second week around, when he looked and he saw these four flights of fighters dedicated every morning to protecting a 123 operation. And he says, you know, what is this? And so he says, take those off of there. And suddenly one morning we were fragging and no fighters. And he says, what's this? You know, well, General Momar's order. So I, at that time, our wing commander of the 315th Air Commando Wing at Consonute there was Colonel Simpson. And I went up and says, here's the problem. You know, we got to have those, not on every mission, but certainly the ones that we recognize to have it. And I'd like to go up and brief General Momar on our mission and get those back. He says, all right. So they got an appointment. And General Momar was there, and Major General at that time, Gordy Graham, who was the DO of 7th, was there. And Colonel Simpson and I went in and briefed General Momar. And he didn't understand what we were doing up to that time. And then he said, well, I recognized his problem before we went in there. He was trying to spread his assets around. And I said, look, we can grade our targets, A, B, C, and D. A would be a target that we have to pre-strike, or we're never going to get in there. That it's just too hot. And the surprise is not going to help us that much. We need to get through there. And I gave him some examples, and I showed him the results of, you know, why we had. And that's how I ended up showing him how many hits we were taking. I described their tactics. I spent about 30 minutes with charts and everything else. And then B targets would be ones that we knew were hot, but we didn't expect such fierce resistance to make the type of the mission or the completion of the mission in doubt. That is, we would probably expend ordnance in the target area based on our throwing smoke out and such. And other targets would be ones that were unknown, Class C type targets, that we would say we don't think there's anything in there. We have not experienced it before, but we're too chicken to go in there without having somebody nearby, and we'd like those guys holding high and dry without hoping to expend too much of the ordnance. And the last category was like the Saigon River, where we go down there and use it as a dumping ground, and we don't have a need that we recognize historically as needing any fighter cover or protection down there. And you know, I stress that fighter cover was two purposes, both to allow us to get in or to allow us to get out, to divert their attention with mass of numbers, or one thing in our mind was to get the helicopters in there and get us out after it was after we were on the ground with some guy. And I was able to give him examples like Paul Clinton and so on. He bought that, and he asked us to try one thing. He asked us to try on our Class B and C type targets to let him give us aircraft on alert out of Benoit and launch off of alert to get up there. And I said, we'll try it, and I'd like to, you know, the option of coming back and telling you how it works. He agreed, and so we took a target up north of Saigon, about 40 miles, and for the first time we didn't have fighters with us up there, and we went in and had three airplanes, and we took 50 caliber fire up there, and I took a couple of hits, and everything seemed all right on the airplane, so we put in our call. And it took the fighter some 40, 45 minutes to get up there. And I went back to him with that, and I said, now, you know, this was pretty close. This was pretty close to Saigon, and even closer to Benoit, where the fighters came out of. And I don't understand, you know, that 40-minute business, and he didn't either.
You better stand on the ground.
Chopped him off because they were supposed to be off the ground in 15, and the flying time up there was 5 to 10, so he couldn't understand that. And I said, here it is, right here. And he looked up and found out I was right. So that that caused him to take some other action there. And for the balance of my time there, we had to use a little judgment on the types of targets that we had. And with the way we planned out our targets and all, with the numbers of people that we had a pretty good feel for it then. We weren't that big an operation as a flight with those 7 to 12 airplanes. The way we would do it, one navigator would have a series of different targets that he would kind of work primarily. And one pilot would have a certain group of targets that he was designated as the target pilot, like on. Those were his targets. Ordinarily, he would lead and plan those missions with the navigator. And so we had a knowledgeable guy right up front, or two of them, that knew what was going on. Now, you know, when I first got there, we had 15 pilots and we had 7 airplanes. So that means that if we flew all our airplanes, that we only had one spare pilot. And so that worked out pretty good. We didn't, while we had young guys, there were only two of us that were majors, Russ Mone and myself. In the outfit. Russ had been the commander when I got there, and because I outranked him, well, I took over as commander, and he became the ops officer. And we had, most of our guys were captains and lieutenants, and from a broad range, guys that one guy was been an English professor at the Air Force Academy, and another guy had been a couple of 121 guys there. And, you know, from across the board, SAC guys and not too many former fighter guys, and there are some 130 types and so on. But we worked out a system where a guy would start off in the right seat and get about 5 missions in the right. Then he'd get 5 missions in the left seat to get qualified. And then he would keep rotating between those seats. If a guy flew the left mission on the first, left seat on the first mission in the day, he flew the right seat on the second. You know, and that way both guys kept their hand in it, both seats. And depending on the guy's target, you know, if you could work out an accommodation like that.
Do you agree with the comments some of the people have made that this was not a one-man airplane, that it took two pilots?
Oh, yeah. Well, fully. One guy could do it. It's a, you know, it depends on what you were doing. As a spray mission, because of the way you had to wrestle the airplane around, one good pilot could do it. But the average guy, I think, to do a good job, took a two-man team. And I stress that word team because I myself have been in a situation where the guy in the right seat, being new, when I, you know, and I got preoccupied, and he'd get behind the power curve on me when I'd be leveling off, and he wouldn't be coming up with the power, and I didn't notice it, and suddenly we'd be sinking, and I'd have to dump flaps or something till I could get the thing going again. We found that teamwork thing to be the best thing, where a guy could concentrate on that, on the one element of airplane control. But obviously one man can fly the 123.
Yeah.
But this was a mission dictated situation as I saw it. So we'd keep a guy firing left, firing right, and then we would go up to Da Nang. We repeated the process in the mountain park. And we had guys that had been designated as IP, you know, with a one-year tour over there. We had, fortunately, some guys that had extended, like Jack Spay and some others. And we had a good crop of IPs there that would keep these guys checked out. But we didn't have a co-pilot, per se. We didn't have a pilot only, per se. We had, everybody was expected
everybody
to carry their share of every load. And they had to later change that after they went into a bigger outfit, I guess, and the non-volunteer, if you will, type of guy that was being in there. Before I left, I guess it was about September of 66, the first non-volunteer guys came in, and by and large, they were as good as anybody else, and I'm not putting them down when I use that term, only to make the point here that the first couple of guys, I think we got five guys in the first group. Three of them were super and turned into probably some of our best ranch hand guys at that point. Two of them didn't fly the first week, and the team up to me and said they didn't want to fly at all. They wanted to transfer out. And I asked them to fly with us for a week, and if they still felt that way, to let me know. And one of them came back after that and says he definitely didn't want to stay. And so we had guys in the Air Commando outfit that wanted to finish out their tour with us. Dick King, for example, was one of those guys that flew about 6 or 8 months with the trash haulers and then came down and finished out with us. He actually went home early because he was wounded in the eye. But the experience level, we just had average guys, and they had this just average type of training. But I think that the adversity in the outfit brought a camaraderie and a spirit that, to me, any other military outfit that I'll ever be in again will be anticlimactic because of that. So much of that.
You mentioned General Momar. Do you feel that the commanders, the leading figures, period, really knew what the ranch was there?
I don't think they did. I think they got the usual briefings and so on. I'm not sure that some of them wanted to know too much. We tried very hard to keep a very cloistered atmosphere there. You see, the physical setting of Consonute lend itself to that. We were in the Vietnamese Coup Squadron area. Nguyen Cao Ky had his own little A-1 squadron and some other little airplanes in his area, Charlie Road. And we were physically located in their area. In order for anyone to get in, we all had the Vietnamese passes and the badges in his area. You could look from here to that motel over there, and 100 feet away was where his landing pad was for his chopper, and his house was right there. And right outside as far as from here to the other side of the swimming pool or less was the wall around his complex and his tanks and machine gunners and all out there, So we were kind of inside the first level, but not in the last level of his security chain there. And so the guys in the wing couldn't get in down there unless we escorted them in, which was good in the Stan of Al sense.
Yeah.
And the safety sense, and the guys that we didn't want in there, But...
Was this relationship how the ranch got associated with Key and the Purple Scarf bit?
Well, you'll have to talk to Jack on some of that.
That was already there?
That was already there. That started off in the, back in 64, I guess, or 65. Or before 65, when reportedly, the story is that Key had flown in a formation with us and so on, and with his A-1s, and was impressed. And offered a scarf. Now, I don't know that to be so. That was only the story that was passed on.
We talked about air. Did you get any of that aircraft support come from Vietnamese?
No.
Strictly U.S.
Well, as I recall now, once or twice we had VNAF A-1s that were offered to us. And I can't factually say that we accepted it. By and large, we tried to keep it within in-house American.
More
communications problem?
That's right. That's what we were concerned about, that we wouldn't, or the FAC, you know, that was really the FAC's problem. We, the FAC would direct the fire. We wouldn't. We
haven't talked about the FACs at all.
FACs primarily were in 01s, and the problem there was compatibility of airspeed. They couldn't keep up with us, so they would meet us at the beginning of the route or a little bit inside the route and then track us down. And if we weren't more than 5 or 10 minutes, well, that was no sweaty job. But if it got more than that, we would outrun him, and he would therefore be behind us. And usually he could employ the fighters, though, fairly well.
And were they marking the start spray points?
Sometimes they would and sometimes they wouldn't. We kind of ran the show. We told them about what time we'd be there. We set up the rendezvous with the FAC and the fighters, and then we all went over the frequency that we wanted. Depended on whether we wanted surprise or not. If we wanted surprise, well, we wouldn't, you know, he knew about where we were going. He knew the target area, but we'd tell him that, you know, we're going to be here and you've got us in sight. Yeah, okay, spray on. Especially some of those areas down in the delta along the coast there, where we used to call it the anti-aircraft school, where we'd come in off the Gulf over the water and use a pop-up procedure, and the whole area along the coast there was target. So if we were off a couple of clicks this way or that way, it didn't make that much difference to us, but it made a big difference as far as just being able to ziggy on through. And at least get a couple of pounds off the airplane unscathed before we started getting it. But on some of the target areas up in war zone C and D, we would ask them to mark it, but we couldn't be any more certain. You know, we were dealing in just a few meters here or there, and we didn't know whether he was any better at reading than what our guys could do on the ground. We had guys like Pete Spivey and Pachurik, and they were good. I mean, you know, they could sit right up there, and we'd, you know, hold a heading and hold the airspeed for them and DR ourselves into pretty good shape and have a few cross-checks. And whether or not we always precisely hit the target, we always said, there's the target, with great confidence, and went after it. You know, we might have been a couple of meters off here or there, and we might have to flare, we might have to abort the whole thing. We weren't proud about doing that. But no, I can't say that we were ever in doubt that we hit the target or hit the right target. I never dumped a load while I was there.
Never dumped one.
Never dumped. Some of the times I should, but I didn't. We can only spray it out.
Did you ever run any of those missions? I've had a couple people talk about. When they tried the effectiveness of going at a reduced spray rate,
yeah,
to spray 28 clicks instead of 14.
Yeah, whatever. We had the, well, we changed that by the RPM on the pump motor in the back. And I think it was a gallon and a half an acre or 3 gallons an acre. And we varied that on different things. And then we did some other things where we tried, you know, the effects of it, run a test swap and so on to see what effect it had. And generally we stayed to the 3 gallons an acre rate, but there were a few things. I think it was based on the using blue, maybe. My memory's a little fuzzy on this. It seems like it was blue that we went at a gallon and a half an acre rate. And along with that also, we did, you know, you may have heard the term pink rose, where they talked about wanting to create a firestorm. And so we ran up to the Chufong Mountains and spent a week or so up there squirting those places. And then we put up a couple of test swaths alongside the Duck Hole camp. And they brought a guy in from the Forestry Service, and they'd go out with him and let him snap twigs and so on and run up the flag when he thought it was ready to burn. And then they said, well, if it's ready here by Duck Hole, it must be ready 10 clicks across the way there in the mountain. So bring in the bombs and the napalm and the phosphorus or whatever it was, the firebomb type stuff that they were using. They brought B-52s in for that. We went up and watched them do it. It started burning and smoldering, but not any significant fires. It looked like a grass fire is what it looked like. And we always kidded them that we could have offered the Montagnards up there a couple of bags of rice and had them go in there and do a lot better job, a whole lot cheaper. But that was where we tried a little varying of spray.
So basically, you were having to develop your own tactics or any modification of tactics.
Yeah.
If you're doing on scene.
We'd have some pretty hot discussions on occasion about what was better here or what was better there. We tried some of the tactics from the guys before, and some of them would seem to fit, and some wouldn't. And you know, we'd toy around with that, kind of play around. I'm sure stronger personalities would prevail in some of those things. The only thing I remember on tactics where I got a little upset with some of the earlier training, some guy back at Hobart, I guess when they moved the training down there, was teaching a guy a crop duster type turn, you know, pull up this way and rudder it around. And I heard about that and I said, no way. Oh, get off of that. But first of all, you're too close to snapping the airplane. The airplane, as much as we thought of it, it had that one real bad characteristic. If you got into the stick shaker and held it there and used rudder, it would snap on you pretty quickly. And so I sent some word back to those guys, knock that crap off, because you know, we're not going to use that over here. We'll do, you know, the regular turns and reverse on target, but none of this business of pulling up. That's kind of dumb in a possibly hot situation. You don't know what it is. Unnecessary in any case. So that kind of tactics. We would generally write out some of our, I can't say write it out in the form of a manual, but the guy knew what he was doing. You didn't have to write it out for him. Some of the new guys came in, they learned from the old guys. And they picked up and they added and modified as they
word
went
of mouth, pass one to the other type.
We didn't have time to sit down, you know, and document a lot of stuff. Well, we did. We didn't take time. Let me put it that way. When you go out, you got up at 4 in the morning and got out and flew, you were finished by 9 or 10. And most of these guys would chogey off, you know, to the club or back to town or something like that. And sure, we might have used some of that time to further our history or, you know. My view, though, has been, make the records you need to support.